It's Monday, June 10, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Who should have access, priority access, to donor organs for transplantation? The whole issue of organ transplantation is filled with ethical quandaries. The most urgent of these is the fact that there are not enough donor organs and that a system of coming up with a fair and equitable way of prioritizing those scarce organs when they are available, well, this presents one of the greatest ethical challenges of the day. All this was made far more difficult last week when a federal judge in Philadelphia intervened to put a 10-year-old girl desperately in need of a lung transplant ahead of others. The issue here was most particularly that her parents had filed suit saying that the National Organ Transplantation Guidelines that do not give children priority in lung transplantation cases put their daughter's life at risk. The federal judge heard their plea and ordered that the girl be put on a higher priority, effectively putting on pause the organ transplantation protocols accepted by hospitals and medical centers across the country. We can immediately understand why loving parents would do just about anything within their power to try to save the life of their precious daughter, and why going to the courts might seem to these parents to be the natural and urgent instinct of their paternal protection of their daughter. But in this case, this federal judge's intervention threatens to create an even larger ethical problem in the system of organ transplantation. As Lauren Neergard for the Associated Press writes, it's a life or death matter. Who gets the next scarce donated organ? In an unprecedented challenge to the nation's transplant system, a federal judge has allowed one dying child, and a day later another, to essentially jump the line in rulings that could have ramifications for thousands of people awaiting new organs. As she goes on to say, the choice to give one patient an organ means almost assuredly the death of some other patient. The protocols and ethical standards for the distribution of donated organs puts a premium on the success of these organ transplant procedures. Since lung transplants are very seldom successful in young children, the priority has been to give donated lungs to adults or to older teenagers. The breaking age here seems to be between 11 and 13. But in this case, this young girl is only 10, but her parents successfully sought redress in the courts. But as medical ethicists are pointing out, this is a huge problem. Dr. Dori Segev of Johns Hopkins University, a transplant surgeon, said this, quote, every choice that is made in transplantation in favor of one patient means the likely death on the list for another patient, end quote. John Roberts, a doctor who heads the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network's board, said on Thursday, quote, the problem is we can't build a system around making exceptions for everybody that isn't getting the transplant when they need it. Furthermore, what about the patients desperately in need of organs who have no one to take their case to the courts? Lawrence Gostin, a prominent health law professor at Georgetown University, questioned the legal basis of the rulings. As he said, quote, people who have privilege or people who complain more loudly or have political voice shouldn't be able to claim special treatment. Transplant policies aim to be fair and just for everyone, not just for that one heart-wrenching case, end quote. Once again, we must state emphatically that we understand that parents would do just about anything to try to save the life of their daughter. They did not act improperly in going to the courts. But legal analysts and medical specialists across the country believe that the court has erred dangerously in intervening in this case. A judge, having no particular medical expertise, has just thrown upside down the entire process for organ transplantation and the procurement of organs in the United States. If anything, this underlines the need for more organs. But at the same time, specialists in organ transplantation point out that there will still be more people needing transplants than there will be likely natural donors of such organs, at least healthy organs that are available for potentially successful transplantation. One of the hardest questions for any ethical worldview is how to distribute scarce resources. In our world, there are few resources more scarce and more urgently invaluable than donated organs for transplantation. The shortage of these organs presents some excruciating moral choices, but that's why there is a set of protocols for organ transplantation and why intervening in them creates all kinds of problems. Oh, and by the way, there's one additional issue here. The argument made by this girl's parents was, at least in part, that her age should qualify her to go to the head of the line, since, in their argument, transplants should go to those who have the longest opportunity to live successfully after the operation, in other words, the young. But as one specialist quickly retorted, then does that mean that we should give an organ priority to a 12-year-old over a 16-year-old or a 16-year-old over a 60-year-old? Those are very difficult questions. The kinds of questions that Christians understand will never be adequately answered in this fallen world. But at the same time, questions that force us to think most carefully about the real issues of justice and fairness in a fallen world. So much of the news coverage in the last several days has been devoted to a national controversy with international reach over the fact that the United States government has been operating as something of a surveillance state, tracking billions of emails, computer actions, and phone calls of American citizens. But as troubled as many Americans seem to be by this surveillance, and regardless of the very weighty issues that are genuinely here at stake, the reality is that most American citizens do not know actually what they want. Do they want the assurance of security from a security state? Or do they want relative, if not absolute, freedom from the intrusion into their personal lives by the state? As Adam Geller reports for the Associated Press, the recent controversy in the United States indicates that Americans aren't sure at all what they want. Americans want to be safe, and Americans want to be free. As Christians should think about this very carefully, we need to recognize that there is a tension between freedom and security. This has been true in every age, and it has been a temptation faced by every government. But as Adam Geller reports, for more than a decade now, Americans have made peace with the uneasy knowledge that someone, government, business, or both, might be watching. We knew, he writes, that the technology was there. We knew that the law might allow it. As we stood under a security camera at a street corner, connected with friends online, or talking on a smartphone equipped with GPS, we knew, too, it was conceivable that we might be monitored. Then he writes, "Now, though, paranoid fantasies have come face to face with reality. The government is collecting our phone records. The technological marvels of our age have opened the door to the National Security Agency's surveillance of Americans' calls. Torn between our desires for privacy and protection, we're forced to decide what we really want." Interestingly, in this article, he cites Neil Richards, a professor at Washington University School of Law, who says, "We are living in the age of surveillance. There's much more watching and much more monitoring, and I think we have a series of important choices to make as a society about how much watching we want." But what's really interesting here is that Americans seem to be quite unwilling to decide the issue. For instance, in the immediate aftermath of the tragic bombings by terrorism at the Boston Marathon, Americans said that they did not like the surveillance state. But then they supported law enforcement when the mechanisms of the surveillance society were used to identify the likely bombers in this case, the Tsarnaev brothers. They were caught, and they were only caught because they were originally identified by the surveillance cameras and the footage from those cameras that were made available in the aftermath of the bombings. Responding to this quandary, David Lyon, who is director of the Surveillance Studies Center at Queen's University in Ontario, Canada, said, quote, "We've allowed surveillance of all kinds to be normalized, domesticated, such that we frequently fail to tell the difference between harmful and helpful surveillance." He went on to say, "And we assume all too easily that if it's high tech, it's better." Writing similarly at the New York Times, op-ed columnist Ross Douthat writes, "Your smartphone is watching you." His column appeared in this past Sunday's edition of the New York Times. He writes, "On Sunday, just after reports broke that the National Security Agency had been helping itself to data from just about every major American internet company, an enterprising Twitter user set up an account called Nothing to Hide, which reproduced tweets from people expressing blithe unconcern about their government's potential access to their emails, phone records, video chats, you name it. One tweet archived at the site said, quote, 'If it can save people from another 9/11-like attack, go for it. My emails, phone calls are not that exciting anyway.' Another tweeted, quote, 'This sort of thing was bound to happen. We live in the information age. Besides, I have nothing to hide.' Yet another wrote, 'If you share your whole life on social media, who cares if the government takes a peek?'" Russ Douthat then responds, "These citizens have a somewhat shaky grasp of how civil liberties are supposed to work, but they do understand the essential nature of life on the internet pretty well. The motto, nothing to hide, nothing to fear, or abandon all privacy, ye who enter here, well, Russ Douthat says that's the very nature of the internet. And that's why, he says, many of our previous discussions about balancing civil liberties or security and freedom, why these debates are now very much out of date, because the very reality of the internet is that it is in itself a surveillance state. If not a government, then a massive surveillance system. And the data that it collects are available to just about anyone who has access. Douthat also raises some very interesting additional issues. It's one thing for the National Security Agency to be trolling all this digital data drawn from Americans, but what about big companies? What about advertisers? Once the cloud has all of this information and has the ability to track even what doesn't require a subpoena or a National Security Intelligence Court to judge, well, it turns out that this big data amounts to a massive surveillance on the American people. And the American people are signing up for it voluntarily, giving away their information, signing away their ability to hide. Going off the grid these days is far more difficult than it was just a matter of 2 or 3 years ago, much less a decade ago. The cloud, this massive new digital grid, is something that virtually no one can escape if you're online to any extent, or if any of your information goes online. Considering what's just happening right now, given the Obamacare legislation about the health care records of Americans, you can understand why it's not just digital data, social media, and what is taken by the surveillance state, by legal authority. It's the everyday data that seems to be now recorded about just about every transaction, every movement, every electronic instrument, every patient, and for that matter, just about every digital thought. 2013 may be remembered for many issues and events, but it will certainly be remembered for the outbreak of tornadoes that took place during the month of May. And no, it wasn't your imagination. It turns out that Oklahoma, the state which was in the headlines so much in terms of this most recent outbreak of tornadoes, is, as the National Weather Service now documents, the most tornado-intensive region of the entire planet. And it's not just the state of Oklahoma, it's the region of central Oklahoma that is particularly vulnerable. As USA Today reports, in fact, of all the F5 or EF5 tornadoes that have hit the United States since 1950, Oklahoma has been hit by 8 more than any other state. An EF5 tornado is any tornado that has wind speeds of 200 miles per hour or higher. The enhanced Fujita scale replaced the Fujita scale in 2007. Oklahoma, the report says, provides a fertile breeding ground for tornadoes because of the clash between the warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico and the cold air from the Rockies and Canada. This time of year, when most big Oklahoma tornadoes occur, that's the month of May, by the way, is key. This was commented on by Greg Carbon, warning coordinator, meteorologist at the Storm Prediction Center. May, he said, has vestiges of winter cold and of the upcoming heat from summer. In other words, it is the time for a collision, and Oklahoma is the most likely place for such a collision. But even or perhaps especially in light of these developments, Sean Murphy for the Associated Press reports that there is now a raging controversy among storm prediction officials about how much warning should be given once the likelihood of a severe tornado outbreak is detected. This is a very interesting question, a relatively new question given modern technologies, but a question that reveals a great deal about human nature. As Murphy reports, in the period since the 1980s, Americans have been given 17 minutes of very precious time. That's the amount of time between the time a warning is given and when a tornado has hit. But that 17 minutes doesn't mean that Americans have 17 minutes before the tornado. It has to do with the fact that in the 1980s, warnings generally were not given until a tornado had been on the ground fully 4 minutes. Now there's a 13-minute warning on average given before a tornado hits. But what's then the controversy? Well, the controversy is between those who believe that 13 minutes is not enough warning and those who believe that it just might be too much. How in the world could there be too much warning? Well, as Murphy reports in this Associated Press article, when some Americans, very much in the path of danger, receive this kind of warning, and they know that they have a few minutes between when the warning is issued and when the tornado might hit, some of them, it turns out that a considerable number of them, are then tempted to try to get something done, to do something, perhaps to intervene in a situation, in what they believe is going to be the lapse of time between the warning and the actual danger. In particular, as Murphy reports, some parents have recently decided, once the warning is given, to try to get to their child's school in order to get them out of the school and home before the tornado hits. But 13 minutes isn't 30 minutes, much less 3 hours. And in the last outbreak of an EF5 storm in Oklahoma, at least some of the injuries and deaths probably took place because people had the warning but did the wrong thing in response to it. One official with the Weather Service, accustomed to making these kinds of decisions, said this, quote, "For years, we've been looking at this from the physical science side, better radars and better science. But we're at this interface where nature and humans intersect. What we're getting to is realizing we need to understand better how people respond to warnings. Maybe we could give people 1 hour. We need to know what the response may be," end quote. And yet, as Murphy makes clear, there is no technology that allows any kind of accurate storm prediction, even in the period of an hour. And if warnings are given in a routine basis with an hour's warning and then the tornado does not hit, human nature means that many will just begin to disregard the warnings. In other words, human nature is a problem, no matter which end of the equation you try to work. This is a very revealing issue from the Christian worldview. The Christian worldview reminds us that we as human beings often act in ways that make sense to us and appear certainly to be in our own best interest. Only we find out later, perhaps far too late, that it wasn't in our best interest at all. It turns out that we, as very frail and finite creatures, actually are not very adept at all, even in understanding where our best interest lies. We often make a very bad miscalculation. Of course, in one sense, that's exactly what sinful humanity looks like. And the worst miscalculation of all was made by Adam and Eve when they took the fruit that was forbidden them and disobeyed their Creator. In other words, our human incompetence in understanding what's best for us goes all the way back to the primal sin of Adam and Eve, our first mother and first father. So the National Weather Service and the storm prediction officials are now trying to figure out what to do with human nature. Well, they might come up with something that will genuinely help, but this much is clear: they will never solve the problem. The scientific consensus on this, in light of this temptation, is probably right. Give people the greatest amount of warning possible, and then hope that they'll make the right decisions. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you today from Houston, Texas, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.